Welcome to Clover Club, a podcast about curious conversations and stories intended to make you laugh and learn. I'm your host, Erica, and today I'm elated to be joined by my friend Mark Kendall. Mark, hi.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm really good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming. You know, You were one of the first people that I've reached out to where I was like, he's not going to say yes to this, but I just am going to ask.
I would absolutely say yes. No, this is very cool.
You said yes, you didn't just say yes. You said yes in like the most flattering way. You were I like listened to it. Like, yeah, I was blown away.
I enjoy the podcast. It's really nice. I love the variety of guests you have. I love the vulnerability of the stories, like from yourself and the other people. You know, people like share their experiences, you know, about like successes and failures.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you appreciating
it.
Yeah, so this is a huge honor for me to have you in the studio.
Yeah.
So typically, Mark, when I have people on the show that I have mutual friends with, and Mark and I, I'll give a tiny backstory. You were my improv teacher like 8 years ago for a hot minute.
Yeah.
And so we just kind of, we overlap in the comedy circle a little, but we do have a handful of mutual friends.
Yes.
And so I've reached out to people and I'm like, I'm recording with Mark Kendall. Do you have any crazy stories, any fun facts, like anything that can add, you know, to this interview?
That's funny.
And the consistent response from everybody was oh my God, we love Mark.
Oh, that's nice.
But also, like, you seem to be the most unproblematic human being in the world.
Okay.
Like, everyone's like, we don't know actually anything about him. Like, he is just always nice, always present, and like, I got no dirt. I got no dirt on you.
Okay.
So I guess are you surprised to hear that?
I don't know. There's definitely dirt out there, I'm sure. Yeah.
Okay. Well, maybe I need to do more reconnaissance work.
Sorry. Yeah.
But I guess, like, do you go out of your way to garner a good reputation? Or I feel like everything people said about you behind your back was lovely. I'm like, this is what everybody would want people to say about them.
Oh, that's super nice.
If they weren't in the room, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I try to have like positive interactions with folks. So I try to do that.
Yeah.
but beyond that, you know, not really.
You're just naturally fabulous.
I just try to have positive exchanges with folks.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when I was younger, someone said something along the lines of like, you know, you can, you know, make someone's day better or worse. And it's not like I necessarily go into an interaction thinking like, I'm going to make the day better or worse, but it's just like, I don't want to make someone's day worse if I can help it, you know?
Yeah.
So maybe that's in the back of my mind a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That took root. I think that's a great way. Like, I'm just going to not make the world worse as I go out into it.
I'm going to try. I still do sometimes, but like, yeah, I'm going to try to.
You'll try to.
Yeah.
That's totally fair. Yeah. Do you ever have bad days?
Absolutely. Yeah. Definitely have bad days. I enjoy doing morning pages. Have you ever done the Artist Way?
I haven't done the Artist Way, but I'm familiar. And I'm familiar with morning pages.
Yes.
Big fan.
Yeah. So just like quick description of Artist Way. It's this workbook, basically. It's like a 12-week workbook where you do creative exercises and read about creativity just in general. I did it maybe over 10 years at this point. I thought it was really beneficial.
Yeah.
One of the aspects of the Artist Way is you journal every morning for about like 3 pages.
Okay.
And so I don't necessarily do it every day, but I have moments when I do it a lot.
Yeah.
And I found that it's just really helpful just in terms of getting thoughts out and processing feelings and things like that. So that's definitely one of the things that I like to go to if I'm having like a bad day. And also like, you know, when I'm being creative with other people, that helps a lot. That helps a lot.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And your comment about being creative with other people, that's such a skill. Mm-hmm. And I learned throughout I had probably like 2 years where I was like deeply dabbling in improv.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned I'm not good at being creative with other people. And I was like, I think I should be doing stand-up instead because I'm just like not good at improv because I think I'm naturally, literally not good at it because I'm like too controlling and I just try to fill in gaps, which is the opposite that you're supposed to, like, I don't know. So are you naturally really good at being collaborative or did you learn to be better through improv?
Yeah, you know, not necessarily. Yeah, I think that, you know, I more naturally tend towards something like stand-up, things like that. And also, too, I mean, like, you know, I saw you in improv class. You're not bad at improv. You know, I think you're very funny. And, you know, I think the other thing, too, like when it comes to doing something that you're doing as a group, no one's ever going to contribute in the exact same way. And so the way I kind of see it is like, all right, there might be some things that, you know, in the moment you look back, or you look back and you're like, oh, that didn't help the improv show.
Yeah.
But also it's just like, that's the offer that you made, whatever that is.
Yeah. Can't unoffer it.
Yeah. So like in a perfect situation, like in an idealized version of improv, it's like whatever you happen to bring is what you bring.
Yeah.
And that's great. You know, so all that to say is like, I think I personally veer more towards, you know, solo performance, solo creative projects as well.
Okay.
But I like how I have to maybe morph or change in order to collaborate with other people.
Yeah.
Know? Even if it's just being like an audience member, you know?
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. So did you get your start? Well, let me even back up from there. Like, how did you get into comedy?
Yeah, yeah. So, in college. Yeah, okay. So in college, I was a film major.
Okay.
And, you know, I was really into, like, you know, writing and directing and making films. Like, I read Spike Lee had, like, these books. I don't remember these books he did. So, like, for, like, his first five films, he had, like, a companion book that would come out.
That sounds familiar. Yeah.
And so it had, like, a journal that he kept. It had the script. And he was basically trying to, like, demystify the filmmaking process. It was sort of like, it was like director's commentary before DVDs and Blu-ray were an option.
That's awesome.
And that was like, man, filmmaking as a process seems so cool. And I was getting really into that. So in college, I'm a film major.
Okay.
And I wanted to get experience with equipment. And there was a sketch group on campus.
Okay.
And YouTube was maybe just out. Like, just like, I'm dating myself, but maybe YouTube was like brand new. So this sketch group, it was a video sketch group, but they wouldn't even put their stuff on YouTube. It's like they would shoot stuff. And then at the end of the semester, they'd have a show where they play video sketches for their friends. And that was kind of it. So I was like, oh, great. I'll be a crew member for this. So I, like, on the weekends, I'd like hold booms or put up lights. And it was great.
Okay.
But another part of being in the group is that every week they'd have writers meetings. So there's a writing team and an acting team. And they would read these sketches and the crew would listen to the sketches.
Okay.
And then you'd give feedback at the end. It was like a really cool process. And I was like, this is fun. And then at around that same time, at the end of my freshman year, Comedy Central had this program that was started by Chris Rock. It was called the Comedy Central Summer School.
Okay.
And it was an opportunity for writers of color to spend the summer at Comedy Central in New York. And they would just kind of like rotate you through departments to expose you to different types of jobs you could have as a writer. And I think it was partly inspired by the fact that, like, when Chris Rock was on SNL, I don't think there were any black writers. So, like, the experience of him getting material on was, like, much different than other people, as I'm sure it was for, like, a bunch of other groups that weren't, like, properly represented on the show.
Yeah.
So that was him and Comedy Central trying to, like, create ways to, you know, address that.
Yeah, good.
So that was freshman year, and I was like, oh, this is cool because it's, like, this is an internship that would pay, and they'd cover my housing, all that kind of stuff.
Nice.
So I applied. And I did not have, like, prior comedic experience. I'm not, like, a class clown type or anything like that. But I wrote sketches for the first time and sent in an application. And I didn't get in, but they left, like, a very nice... It was a complete failure, but I felt great about it because I tried really hard on that application.
I prepared for this beautiful story of your summer in New York.
I didn't get in, but they left a very encouraging email. Like, we liked your application, and we'd love for you to apply again. So I kept that voicemail in my phone, like, the whole year, and occasionally I'd listen to it, like, yo, they really liked my application. I'm gonna do this again.
Do big things.
Yeah, so then the next year, I submit again, and this time the East Coast director of development called me up because he was a Northwestern alum.
Okay.
I didn't get in the second year either.
Did you go to Northwestern?
Oh, yeah, I did. So, okay. Yeah, those are at Northwestern. Yeah, okay. Yeah. That would have been random. Sorry. Yeah, we went to the same school. That's why he called me up. And and he's like, yo, I like your stuff or whatever, but it's not really, you're not going to, like, get to the next level with this. And he sat on the phone with me. And when you work in development, you're the person that's kind of, like, deciding what scripts, you know, go from being scripts to becoming TV shows. So you're, like, developing it. So this person is an expert on reading and understanding not just what's funny, but what's also a fit for Comedy Central. So he read my samples, which is wild, and kind of like walked me through them. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I thought my samples were great because it's just like my friends thought they were funny.
Right.
And he's just like, that's cool, but you need to make a stranger laugh really hard from reading the words on the page. And I'm like, I really took that to heart.
It's a good tip.
Yeah, it was a really great tip. And so then I remembered that. And so then I applied a third year and I got in. And so that was great. Yeah, yeah. And so I was like, oh, fantastic. And so I spent the summer in New York. And so you'd rotate through different departments. So you spent time in the development department. So that Northwestern alum, I got to work in his department for a couple weeks. And then they had a blog back then. So I got to like be at the blog for a little while. And I wrote a blog post for them. I was in their on off air promotion. So I got to pitch like ideas to them. But the fun part of the program was I got to spend a week shadowing the writers at The Daily Show with Jon Stewart.
Oh my God.
And then I got to spend a week shadowing the writers at the Colbert Report.
Wow.
And so what that meant was I wasn't really like getting coffee or anything like that. I'd show up, I'd go to all the writers' meetings, and then if I felt like it, I'd pitch a joke or two. And it was a really eye-opening experience because up until that point, you know, I'd been a crew person, I had written stuff, but I'd never been in a room where you're pitching jokes verbally. I'd always like been off in my own like dorm room writing a script to myself and then shooting it myself or turning it in. What's different about these TV writers' rooms, or at least how they worked in those rooms, is like you are off on a computer writing stuff, but there are moments when you're pitching concepts, you're pitching jokes. And what I had to learn to get better at was one, like just pitching out loud in a room because I was not a performer.
Yeah.
And also, you know, you might write something that reads funny, but can you give someone a line that they then say later that evening out loud to an audience that's in their voice that's also funny? So it's like a different skill kind of.
Sure.
And so that was a great experience, like learning what that looked like. And one thing that was like a really big confidence builder for me was at the Colbert Report, I pitched a joke and a version of that wound up on the show. So like Colbert said like a joke that like started as my idea. And I was like, oh my gosh. And all the writers were very kind and encouraging, like, oh, good job, you know? And, you know, I really dug the vibe of the Colbert Report writer's room. And what I found out was that like a lot of them were improvisers from Chicago. Mm. And I was going to college in a suburb of Chicago. So a lot of those writers also went to the school that I had gone to. And they're like, you should, when you go back to school, try some improv, try some stand-up. Those are things that will help you pitch. So, because what I was observing was like, you know, you go into the office each day with these writers, they'd pitch these brilliant jokes, and then they would then go to the clubs at night and then do their own material. So I started to follow them doing that. I'm like, oh, okay, this makes sense. They're not just writers. They're brilliant performers in their own right.
Yeah.
Nearly all of them, even if they weren't like performers, they had some kind of performance experience. So I'm like, okay, this is something if I want to write, this is something that I need to learn how to do if I want to write in these kind of spaces.
Sure.
And so my roommate during that summer, who was also part of the program, he was already a stand-up. So he was like going out each night. So I started following him. And I went up and did my first stand-up open mic. It was like in the basement of this taco spot. And it didn't go good, but it's just like, what I found was like, oh, like speaking in front of people, that doesn't really make me nervous. I didn't do that great. I was fine. So I'm like, oh, okay, I can do this. And I think also a certain level of pressure was removed because I'm like, I'm not trying to be a stand-up. I'm just trying to do this to get better at writing. So there was like a layer removed. Whereas maybe it would be a lot different if my whole life I'm like, oh gosh, I want to be like Richard Pryor, Steve Martin, and I got to make this work. You're bad for a really long time, you know? So it's like, I can see how that could maybe be a tougher thing. But to me, I'm just like, I'm just trying to learn to write jokes, you know? So there was a lot that was removed from that. And so then when I came back to school for my senior year, I started going to open mics for stand-up on occasion. I took my first improv class while also still, you know, writing and making stuff. So that's kind of how comedy kind of came about. And I think the other thing too was, you know, being in film school at the time, you'd watch a lot of student films. Mm-hmm. And at least when I was in film school, what I appreciated about the comedy ones was like, if something was meant to be funny, like the audience would either laugh or they wouldn't.
Yeah.
But for other films, you know, you're trying to make like a historical drama, but on like a $250 budget, it was kind of hard to determine, like, I don't know, like your dorm room doesn't look like 1920s France, you know? Like, So if that makes any sense. So what I appreciate about comedy was that, like, oh, I like it where it's like you try to make the audience have a certain reaction, mm-hmm. and they either do or they don't, and then you kind of go back to the drawing board if you didn't get what you wanted.
Yeah.
And so that's the long story.
I love that story. That's super cool. Yeah. Are there any people that were in those writer rooms that have now gone on to have big kind of individual careers?
Yeah. So like at the Daily Show when I was there, it was like Wyatt Cenac's like first week or something like that.
Okay.
Where he like just got there. And so he went on to be like a great correspondent and then did a bunch of stuff. John Oliver was a correspondent at the time and as well as in the writer's room. And I remember like the first or second day at the Daily Show, there was like one of those like office basketball goals.
Uh-huh.
And like, he was just very nice. Like I remember like, he's like, I forget how it started, but he's like, want to play horse or something like that. And like, we played horse on the thing and I lost and I was going to pay him $10. He's like, I can't take your money. It's true. He shouldn't be taking my money. But like, and also during the program, we would go to like Comedy Central events too. So Comedy Central had like a lot of stand-up shows around town. So it was, so that summer I saw Bo Burnham when he like just moved to New York. He was maybe like 19 at the time.
Oh my God.
He may have still been like in school or something.
Yeah.
I saw Hannibal Buress before I had seen him on TV. I think maybe before he'd shown up on TV.
Okay.
Amy Schumer was still like very, very new. So like you'd go see these people at the show and then they'd still just be hanging out after the show.
Yeah.
And you would just be talking to them. So I saw Mike Birbiglia for the first time that summer.
Nice.
Just a bunch of people.
Yeah.
Just a bunch of people. It was really nice. Yeah.
I feel like when I hear stories like this, mm-hmm. it's like way more cutthroat. And I love that you're like, oh, I had a lovely experience and everybody was really uplifting and kind.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the perfect experience you'd have because that's how you show up in these rooms now with other people.
Yeah. And I will also say too, not that it wasn't a lovely experience, but I think that some things can feel rough. So it's like, I did also pitch jokes that did not go well.
Sure.
And like, you might get a look. And so like, depending on what your emotional state is on that day, maybe that might make you feel really bad.
Yeah.
Or it's just like, people will give you very direct, honest feedback. Like, this sucks.
Yeah.
And maybe they raise their voice or something like that. And it's not like, nothing scary.
Sure.
But it's like, depending on the day or your temperament, mm-hmm. that might throw you off or whatever. So,
sure.
But that said, I mean, these were shows that were operating at like a really high level.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't really have that kind of energy. Like something that would get said in the Daily Show, I think, was like best idea wins. Meaning like they didn't care if the intern had the idea or Jon Stewart had the idea or whoever.
Right.
It's just like they're trying to create an environment so that the best idea gets heard so that can wind up on the show because that's good for the show. And so there's that too. Because I mean, not all creative spaces are like that. Some are much more toxic.
Yes.
It's just for that particular program, I didn't encounter much of that.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. And I'm so glad you finally got accepted.
Oh, yeah.
Third time's a charm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So, okay. So you have this experience. You graduate from college.
Mm-hmm.
I know there were probably a couple years in between that and when I met you as an improv teacher. So how did you get to like connect the dots for me between there and now? Because I've seen you perform at the Alliance in your own solo show, which I want to circle back to. I mean, you've done some awesome shit.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like how has all this unfolded for you?
Yeah, so I came back to Atlanta and originally I was like, oh, I'm only going to be in
Sorry. Are you originally from Atlanta?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So I came back to Atlanta after college. Atlanta's where I'm from. And originally I thought like, oh, because all my friends from college were mostly going to the coast, like New York or LA, because that's where most of the filmmaking is happening. But I came back to Atlanta and I was very briefly for like a hot second, I was one of the casting assistants at Tyler Perry Studios. So
cool.
It was back when they were filming Meet the Browns and House of Pain. And that was a really great learning experience. It was just a very short period of time. But in that short period of time, I got to see a lot. So the casting department that I was at, they were casting for two shows at the same time.
Oh, wow.
So Tyler Perry, he kind of like pioneered this style of shooting sitcoms where, you know, maybe back in the day, you'd shoot like a sitcom a week. Mm-hmm. And then each season you'd have like 22 or 24 episodes at a certain, it's not as common to do that anymore, but that's kind of like what it was like. What Tyler Perry did with his studio, he would shoot like four episodes a week and shoot a bunch over the course of like 3 or 4 months. And then he'd have like 80 episodes of TV and just have like much more And he was just doing it for much cheaper. So what that meant for the casting department is, rather than casting for like, I don't know, like an episode of TV a week, you would cast for like 8 episodes of TV a week.
Oh, wow.
So then you're seeing that many more auditions.
Yeah. You know? Was that efficient or overwhelming?
I was just an assistant. I'm sure it was overwhelming for some people.
Yeah.
But I don't know if my job necessarily changed that much. It's not like I was like doing 8 times as much, if that makes sense.
Okay. Okay. Gotcha.
So I'm sure that fell on someone. It just didn't fall on me.
Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah. But what I got to take away from that was, you know, just how often like you would see, or this is just my experience, but it's like I'd see auditions for a role and I'd have my favorites like, oh, that person was clearly the best. They wouldn't necessarily get the role.
Interesting.
You know, like it was super interesting. Like, or, you know, someone might not get a role for something, but they made a great impression. Mm-hmm. And so then they'd get brought back and it's like, oh, okay. Just worry about what you can kind of control.
Yeah.
And just try and go and have a good audition. You see like interesting choices, things that are maybe more boring choices. So like you see 20 people do the same line. And so you see how many people make the same choice versus the people that do a little something different. All that was really cool. And then I met some writers of the show at the time, some of those folks I'm still in touch with. And so, yeah, it was a good learning experience. It definitely wasn't what, I don't know what I was expecting.
Yeah.
But like, it wasn't what I was expecting. You know, yeah. Like, but looking back on it, those are the positive things that I took out of it.
Okay.
But then after that ended. And I wanted to make sure that I continued to work the performance muscles in addition to writing. And so after that, I became the former artistic director at Dad's Garage. His name's Kevin Gleese. Mm-hmm. I was his intern.
Okay.
So basically what that means, I go in a couple times a week and like, you know, help Tim with stuff, like admin stuff.
Tell him his hair looks good.
Yeah. And then they gave me free classes.
Oh.
And that was really nice because it's just like that helped me be able to take improv classes. They're expensive.
Sure.
And Amber Nash, she was the education director at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I was like, hey, Amber, you know, I get free classes. Y'all have 4 levels. Can I just take all 4 of them at once? And she's just like, yeah. And so, so I had, you know, extra evening time on my hands.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just take all the classes at once. And I did that like maybe a couple times throughout my internship.
Wow.
And slowly over time, like, you know, I would take classes at one place. I start performing someplace else. And so over time, like I accumulated like stage time and reps through that. Cause I didn't really study acting in college. Not really. I mean, I maybe took like a couple acting classes, but I wasn't like an acting major. And I think I sometimes maybe felt not insecure, but I didn't feel like a trained actor. Cause I had friends that were like, that was their craft. And I saw how seriously they took it in college and like what that looked like. And I'm like, that ain't me.
Yeah.
And so I was trying to like, not catch up isn't the right word, but I was like, all right, I've seen how seriously my friends take acting. I want to try to apply that to like my improv stuff and to this comedy stuff that I'm going to do. And so I got to perform more at Dad's Garage, and something that is unique about how that theater works, or at least it was when I was there. I'm not there currently, but back when I was performing there, they're an improv theater, so they put on improvised comedy shows.
Mm-hmm.
They're also a theater company, so they have like a scripted season of theater that they do each year as well.
Sure.
And what was unique about the way they did theater was they had the improvisers write most of the scripts.
Mm.
And so if you're a playwright, at least like in Atlanta, you might write a play, but getting a theater to produce your work can be a challenge if you don't have a relationship with that theater, you know? And even if you do, it can just be tough.
Yeah.
So what Dad's Garage allowed for were newer playwrights. Maybe you've never had anything produced, but you could get something produced there.
Okay.
So I've been there for a little while, and I pitched a solo show called The Magic Negro and Other Blackness, and it was a satirical one-person sketch show looking at the magic Negro archetype that pops up in American culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to do that. And then I was like teaching improv and then touring with that touring with that solo show. And yeah. So that's the solo show I mentioned earlier. That's how that came to be.
Okay. That's interesting. I didn't realize that it had started at Dad's. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. I have a funny story that I think of and bring up with a friend of mine that I saw your show with actually fairly regularly. Mm-hmm. So this show that Mark referenced, he did at the Alliance Theater. And I took a good friend of mine and we were like, we should get stoned first. Are you cool with talking about weed? Okay.
I just think it's really funny. It's because, funny side story. You're not the only person that's come to see the show really high.
I feel like it's not like a weird combination. No, like, you want to get stoned and laugh? my favorite combination. we got there a little early. Mm-hmm. We're sitting in the parking garage at the Alliance, and I had brought my weed, my grinder, and literally a bowl. Yeah. And this friend that I was with, he is married and didn't get out much. Mm-hmm. And he's my fun buddy. Uh-huh. And I'm like, do you want to hit this? And he was and so I hit the bowl. I hand him the bowl. Mm-hmm. We're passing it back and forth. We're just hotboxing my little whatever car I drove at the time, just giggling, having a wonderful time. Mm-hmm. And then he had one of those stoned thoughts of you know how when you hit a bowl, you inhale? I wonder what happens if you exhale. And so he exhaled, and all of this weed, it just goes all over my car. It was Puff the Magic Dragon. Wow. I sold that car, and there were definitely weed bits everywhere. I mean, it was like a bomb went off. Right. And I just looked at him, and I'm like, bro, what the fuck? And we just could not stop laughing. And then I was like, well, I guess that's that. Yeah. Let's go keep it going. Right. And then we came in and watched your show. Yeah. And it was great start to finish, of course, because I think you're hilarious.
Oh, thank you.
But there's this one segment that I literally reference this regularly, but it's the part about Marta.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life.
Thank you.
I don't know if it's because I'm an Atlantan lifelong and I just get it, but will you tell me about the inspiration for that and just kind of tell people what I'm referring to?
Sure.
Because I feel I'll butcher it, but you're obviously.
Sure, yeah. So I have a bit that started from that show called, If Marta Expanded to Cobb County. So in Atlanta, Marta is our public transportation system. There's a train system, but it's fairly limited. It's more limited than it should be for a city of Atlanta's size.
Yes.
And then that contributes a lot to traffic and a lot of other byproducts of not having enough public transportation and just people having a way to get to where they need to go.
Yeah.
Cobb County is a suburb of Atlanta, and they have not allowed MARTA to expand to the suburb in the way that it should at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years, a big narrative of why, public transportation would not expand to that part of town is because, we don't want public transportation to come here because we don't want crime to come here. Crime being another word for black people, basically.
Yep.
If you look at the history of traffic, public transportation, streets in Atlanta, the way that it's carved up, divided. Yeah, just in general, roads, the ground you walk on.
Yeah.
A lot of the way that it's been, manufactured is due to, racism and a fear of societies and neighborhoods mixing in one way or another. And this narrative of public transportation bringing crime is a thread that you even will still hear today. It's
absolutely
really, it's wild.
Yeah.
But if you think about what it would actually take for someone to take public transportation to steal something that you value in your home, like a television set or a sofa, and then get back onto a bus and then a train is wild, so that's kind of what the bit is about. I take on the perspective of a thief, a robber, whoever, and I'm talking to my boys and I'm like, yo, Cobb County just opened the floodgates. They expanded MARTA to Cobb County, so we're going to rob Cobb County tonight. We're bringing black crime to Cobb County, And so I take a very detailed look of what it would actually take. And as I'm breaking it down to you, you're like, wait, this is impossible. This doesn't make any sense. And so that's kind of what that bit's about.
It's so, so, so good.
Oh, thank you.
And was it an April Fool's joke? Did Kemp just approve funding to expand MARTA, or was that an April Fool's joke? Do you know?
Oh, I do know that there are additional MARTA stops being added.
Okay.
But I don't know if it's necessarily being expanded to those spots.
Okay.
So I'm not I guess the short way of saying is I'm not sure exactly.
Okay. I'll have to do a little research and I'll leave that in the show notes.
Sure.
But every time MARTA comes up, I'm always like, just because people naturally are like, oh, crime. It's like you bring up this part of like bringing a baby grand piano on the MARTA bus. And it's just like, no one's going to do this. Yeah. That's not how this works.
Yeah.
So I guess you've done and continue to do a really nice job of infusing a kind of social awareness and politics into your comedy. Mm-hmm. And that's brought you to kind of where you're at now and the podcast that you have.
Sure.
So will you tell us a little bit about how you continue doing that?
Absolutely. Well, you know, going back to that experience at Comedy Central in New York that I had, you know, Tom Purcell, who was the head writer of the Colbert Report at the time, he was the person that would be reading a lot of the writing that I was just doing when I was there for that week. Mm-hmm. And something that I wasn't good at the time, but he really pushed, was having a very strong point of view and writing something that you care about.
Yeah.
And that, like, you know what you care about subconsciously, but you may not necessarily know what you have a point of view on because you just think about it every day.
Sure.
And so for me, that experience was helpful in starting to develop, like, what are things that I do care about? What do I have a point of view on? And also being, you know, with the Colbert Report and the Daily Show, a lot of it is simply like drawing inspiration from current events, broader things that are happening. Mm-hmm. I think another way to look at it is like, you know, what's happening in your own neighborhoods, in your own hometown, whatever that may be, you know? And so using the MARTA piece as an example about how that kind of led to what I'm doing now. So, you know, that was part of a show that I toured for a number of years, and Bill Worley, he's an improviser in town, also a really talented filmmaker. And quick sidebar, so I've known Bill for over 10 years at this point. I mean, and I've been saying that for a couple years, so however many years that is. But we worked on a project together. It was a show we did. It was me, Bill Worley, and John Mangan, who's another great actor in town. And John Mangan had this idea that we had both kind of talked about called like Magic and Bird. He's like, what if we did a live stage adaptation of the rivalry between Magic Johnson and Larry Bird? It was very, very silly and very ridiculous. And neither one of us looked like Magic Johnson or Larry Bird, but it was very fun. So we like had the jerseys and we were doing like this live show. And it was just this bonkers, bonkers show that would also have like little documentary snippets throughout that Bill shot. And we also did a sketch for it. And I just really enjoyed the experience of working with Bill. And I was like, yo, this was a great experience. Would you want to shoot something else with me? And he's like, yeah. And so I had these sketches, you know, from my solo show. So we shot the MARTA piece. And then like 2 weeks later, the world shut down. Yeah. So like I wasn't performing or anything like that. And, you know, that's most of what I've been doing. I've been going out every night to, you know, teach improv, to perform someplace, doing something. And so we were just kind of sitting on this sketch for months. But then after a while, we're like, I think we should just kind of put it out because it's like some of the things that it brings up are related to conversations that were being had at the time around like, you know, race, equity, you know, all these kind of things, right? And then that did well. It resonated with folks. Mm-hmm. And what I kind of learned from that experience was like, oh, you know, a point of view can be about something very specific to you. So like, you know, this very like niche issue in Atlanta. But what would happen is because I was so specific with it, when I talk to people in other cities, or I've even been to Canada and done this bit, it's like people all over the country, unfortunately, have some version of what's happening in MARTA, where people don't want a group to be in a certain space, you know, so they're doing things to keep people out.
Yeah.
And so that resonated with folks. And, you know, again, working with Bill was fantastic. So we kind of started putting out safely, like these solo sketches that I had, because we were able to either shoot like outdoors or like socially distance. And it got momentum. And we were eventually approached by some folks to make videos around voting, fair districting, all these different things. So we're like, oh, people are asking us to, they want to pay us to do this. So we formed a production company.
Awesome.
And so that production company is called Cool 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 Productions. And so we've taken on clients like New Georgia Project and Fair Count. We've worked with Adult Swim. You know, we're working with United Way of Greater Atlanta right now for a certain project. And what we found is like the things that Bill and I just kind of like naturally tend towards are things like civic engagement, community building. These are things that we just like anyway.
Yeah.
We like talking about Atlanta, right? And so the production company uses comedy as a way to discuss these topics. Something that we found was, you know, if you talk to someone about like boating, let's say, it can be rough. You know what I mean? Because it's like, especially being in a place like Georgia during an election season, you find yourself being inundated with all types of media, phone call, text, mail, knocks on doors, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And it can be a lot, even if those things are coming from a great place.
Mm-hmm.
But what we found is with comedy, specifically comedy that is attempting to incite joy in some way, that makes you more likely to take some form of an action. You know, there's also really important comedy being done that's like more satirical or whatever.
Yeah.
That's also really important, I think, necessary for like a dialogue.
Sure.
But it's just like that may not necessarily make you take an action. So it's like a slightly different thing to use a form of comedy that incites some form of like joy specifically.
Yeah.
And those are also really useful tools against like misinformation or just like being depressed about a topic. And so for these organizations that we were working with, a lot of times they may not necessarily use comedy all the time. Some of them did, but they may not necessarily use comedy all the time. And what they found was like, oh, when we have like this dense, complicated new information that we're trying to get to our audiences, what they found when they work with us is like, oh, well, because we use comedy, it's more surprising, it's more engaging. And a lot of times if you hear something new for the first time, it can be challenging. You know, like I know in my experience, I hear something new that runs counter to what I already know.
Yeah.
I'm more likely to like knock it down.
Sure.
But if it's something that's making me laugh as I'm hearing it, I might be like, oh, that's kind of interesting. You know, I'll think about that.
Yeah.
And you're more likely to, you know, think about that topic over time.
Yeah.
And maybe I might be more likely to change my mind as opposed to like holding tighter to what I already think to be true.
Right.
And so that's what we found. And so we've gotten a chance to do like a lot of really cool projects because of that. One of them is our podcast we have in collaboration with WABE, which is called What's Good Atlanta. And so it's a podcast I co-host with the great comedian David Perdue, not the politician, the comedian.
To be clear.
Yeah. And we take, you know, positive, uplifting stories in and around Atlanta. And we kind of just talk about what's good, literally. It's a very short 10 or 11 minute podcast. Bill will also do person on the street interviews with folks where he'll literally go to like Piedmont Park or wherever he's at.
Oh, cool.
And ask people like, hey, what's good? And so, yeah, so that's kind of how that partnership came to be.
That's so awesome. Mm-hmm. Do you enjoy podcasting?
I do. It's definitely like a skill. Like, so Bill and I, we had a podcast with iHeartMedia for a while called Ridiculous News, and that was a great learning experience. I enjoyed that too.
I enjoyed that very much.
Oh, thank you. But what I learned is it's like I had to learn a bunch of things. I mean, like there's definitely like a learning curve.
Absolutely.
I think for me, when I first started podcasting, I got so self-conscious about just saying the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. And I think what has helped since then is knowing like, I'm going to say the wrong thing sometimes because I'm like an imperfect person.
Sure.
I might say something that I'm embarrassed by later, but I've learned to kind of let that go a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because being in my head about that doesn't really help me, you know?
That's correct.
And then also just working with folks that I think are great, like David and Bill and our producer, Scotty, you know, all that helps, you know?
Sure.
So it is something that I do enjoy, but it was also very much like a learning curve for sure.
Yeah. Well, I can obviously relate to that learning curve.
Yeah.
It is steep, but I think rewarding.
Yeah.
And it's leading you to tonight. You're doing a live show of this podcast.
Yes.
Did you ever do anything live with Ridiculous News? Will this be your first foray into live podcasting?
Yeah. So for Ridiculous.
Asking for a friend.
Yeah. So for Ridiculous News, we never did a live thing. And with WABE, I think because it's a little bit more locally focused, like WABE, they're out in the community a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So and because David and I are both live performers, it kind of makes it a little bit more organic for us to do live stuff. So, for example, last week we did our first live episode. There was 404 Day.
Oh, yeah.
So we were at 404 Day and we did a live episode. We talked to Tori, who is one of the founders of Atlanta Influences Everything.
Nice.
And it was a really nice time. And so with this show, this tonight, I'm very excited about it. So it's going to be part comedy variety show, part David and I like hopping on mics to record our podcast as well.
Okay.
So it's going to be a little bit of everything. It truly is like an experiment. And it came about because I do work with this organization called the Center for Artistic Activism. So I was a fellow of theirs last year, and occasionally I'll help facilitate workshops with them or collaborate on different projects.
Mm-hmm.
And they provided some funding to basically carry out a civic experiment, being like, hey, how can you increase excitement around voting in a time when people are not, you know?
Yes.
And so my pitch was, it's just like, all right, well, I'm going to put on this variety show. I'm going to give out free donuts. I'm going to give out thank you cards that I've written. And I'm going to bring folks together. And we're going to have stand-up comics. We're going to have poets. But in the middle, we're going to talk about civic engagement. So we've invited Ensei Ufot, who is a brilliant mind. She used to run New Georgia Project, does all kinds of really cool voting work around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the goal for tonight, I don't know what we're going to talk about, but the goal ideally is that we talk about, you know, how she finds joy in her work, how she finds joy in voting.
Yeah.
And then we're also interviewing a former guest of yours, actually. So I was listening to your Ooh. Podcast research, Alex, the Atlanta Magnet Man.
Oh my God, you're
yeah,
kidding.
Yeah.
I need royalties. Yeah, this is getting ridiculous.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So listening to your interview was amazing. It was a great interview. And so what was funny was we talked about him on the podcast once. And we were like, oh, it'd be cool to talk to him.
Yeah.
And then I found like, oh, Erica's talked to Alex before. And
yeah, I've lived next door to him for 16 years.
And what's great about the work that Alex does, picking up the nails and debris from the road, It's like just another form of civic engagement,
Absolutely.
You know? And so what I'm curious to see is like, you know, talking about voting directly, but also talking about other forms of civic engagement and just how there's a lot of different entry points and just from two completely different people.
Yeah.
And so,
that's dope.
Yeah. And so
that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's really just kind of like an experiment. And the Center for Artistic Activism, they're like, it's an experiment, meaning like it can be a success or a failure. So don't be afraid to fail with it.
And so
I'm trying to remember that because I think a lot of times when I produce a live show or whatever, I'm hosting something or making a video, I'm like, I cling tight to it being like, it's got to be good.
Yeah.
It's got to be a success. And what I'm trying to remind myself for this is like, you know, it's okay if it's not. And I don't think it's going to be a good time. It's not that, but it's more so just allowing myself to just experiment with it and being like, all right, so like we're trying to mush these things together. If at some point it gets rocky, learn from that because then I can do another one at
Absolutely.
Some point. And so that's kind of like the attitude I'm trying to take into this evening.
I think it's wonderful because I think for me, I'm such a perfectionist.
Yeah.
And when it comes to creative endeavors, those two things don't necessarily mix because you have to just put it out there and kind of see what happens.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's just the best attitude to have of, you know, we're going to learn from this one way or another. And I think defining success and failure for yourself too is, you know, like just an individual thing. So.
Yeah. Thanks. I appreciate it. Like a goal for mine, like this just in general, creatively has been to try to like, just put more out there in general. Like I think that there are seasons when like I'm doing more or I'm doing less.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of like, let me say yes to a few more shows that normally I may not normally do. So I perform with people that I haven't performed with before.
Mm-hmm.
Let me apply to some things that like I wouldn't normally apply to just for the sake of doing it, you know? So I've been trying to do more of that, knowing that it's not going to be perfect each time. And
sure.
so, but I feel like when you're putting that energy out there I wanted more of that feeling.
Yeah.
Being like, oh, what have I done? You know? Yeah. So yeah.
I like that a lot. And that was one of my favorite takeaways from doing improv was like driving home after an improv class and like analyzing what I did, what I would have done differently. And it's like these little quick kind of forays into being vulnerable and trying new things with kind of a low bar of risk at the end of the day.
May I have a question for you? If that's
sure.
Like,
please.
Yeah. So like when you mentioned being a perfectionist and like, I feel like I am as well. Like, what are things?
When's your birthday?
The 15th of September.
Oh, you're a Virgo. That's why.
Okay.
Me too. Sorry. I was like, I already know the answer to this, but let me just ask. Okay. Sorry to interrupt you.
No,
what were you
good.
Asking me?
So you mentioned being a perfectionist. I'm curious, like for yourself, like what do you do to either balance that out, you know, like what do you, when, and that comes up?
That's a wonderful question. Mm-hmm. So I find that if I do a lot of kind of legwork in advance, and mm-hmm. I can use, here's a really good example. Mm-hmm. This past Sunday night, mm-hmm. I hosted a sound bath here at the shop. There's this woman, Natasha Riles, who's a Atlanta woman who is awesome. She just does mm-hmm. these amazing sound baths. And I wanted to kind of introduce that to my clients here. But again, I'm very kind of particular about the flow of things and da da da. So I literally meditated and I just forced myself to just picture like start to finish how that whole experience would go. Wow. And then I wrote it all down. Yeah. And then I, in a non-meditative state, read through it and just kind of pictured analytically, like, how's that going to work? Da 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 da. So I think I go out of my way, and maybe it's a little anxiety too, but to kind of in advance figure out, oh, that's not going to work, or here's a pitfall potential here. So I like to eliminate kind of obvious issues or failures that could come with an idea. And then I'm like, okay, I'm more relaxed and I can show up to this and be kind of open and just let it unfold. And things didn't go exactly the way that I had written down in my little list mm-hmm. on Sunday, but they probably went better. Right. And we got great feedback and it was a wonderful event. And yeah, so I think I try to get ahead of potential issues from the jump and then just know like, hey, you've done what you can as far as that goes. Now you just have to show up and just be present.
Wow. I love the what you mentioned about meditating it, writing it down, reading it.
Yeah.
I'm going to take that.
You should. Yeah. And I'm sure you know this with your morning pages. It's mm-hmm. like there's something about pen to paper that like really just it does something in your neural pathways that a scientist could tell you about mm-hmm. better than I can. Mm-hmm. But I really do like feel better just kind of physically getting it out. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a very, very important part of my mm-hmm. my creative process.
Yeah, that's really helpful to hear that. That's
yeah.
Great. Yeah.
Well, feel free tomorrow.
Sure.
I remember what I was going to ask you before. Okay. Yeah. So you referenced COVID. Mm-hmm. Is this your main source of income? Like how did you fare COVID? Because as a creative, and same for me, like I didn't work for 3 months. I had no income for 3 months. It's scary. Mm-hmm. So how did you navigate that? How did it impact you?
Oh, it changed. I mean, everything went upside down. Yeah. So it's just like, fortunately, like certain gigs that I had did move to being virtual, mm-hmm. you know? So like RIP Creative Circus, for example, like that's an example of like a gig I had where I was teaching in person and that moved to virtual.
Oh, cool.
Fortunately, like things like that did happen. Mm-hmm. And like, because more things were moving virtually, more gigs moved virtually, which was nice.
Yeah.
But it really like shifted a whole bunch.
Yeah.
Because I mean, before the pandemic, like I mentioned, I was mostly saw myself as like a live performer. And post pandemic, I still perform when I can, but so much more of my time now goes towards things that are in some way related to, you know, building up this production company, mm-hmm. whether it's like trying to plan for a shoot, but also more so just like building relationships with folks that we work with or are in similar fields, like not even necessarily to work with them, but just like to build these relationships. So it's just like the way, also like I went from being like a night person, you know, because it's just like, you just be out all night to now like, I'm like, oh man, I think I've been a morning person this whole time. so it's like, you know, like, and I can do the late night thing, but I think I'm more naturally like a morning person. So
interesting.
I could probably talk for a while about all the things that changed, but it was definitely like a very big shift.
Yeah.
What about yourself?
Like, it's interesting. Kind of similar to you. Yeah. I took advantage of the downtime and I did kind of learn about myself in ways that I didn't have the opportunity to when you're just like, you got your schedule. You're like, I go to work on these days. I sleep at these times. I socialize at these times. Everything was kind of pre-prescribed. And I'd been doing things the same way for so long. I there wasn't an opportunity to take a step back and assess, is this in tune with my natural, like, inclinations and body rhythms and all of that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. So kind of like you, I'm like, yeah, I like to go to bed kind of early. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call myself a morning person either per se. Like I just like to sleep. I enjoyed the leisure, mm-hmm. but I enjoy an income even mm-hmm. more. There was actually, I don't know if you remember this. It mm-hmm. was when you were teaching, I broke my finger. Do you remember I came in with like a giant cast? This was like 8 years ago. But that planted the seed of like, I need to have like revenue and income that isn't based solely on me cutting hair or being physically present at work, which kind of for you as a live performer, it's like, mm-hmm. okay, you got to diversify. Mm-hmm. And so COVID kind of really was a a supercharged, like, dip back into that mindset of like, you gotta shake things up. And so that was kind of where I had the idea of branching more into retail. And I started working with this business coach, and she's the one that she's like, you have to do this podcast thing. Yeah. And a podcast had come up a lot of times, and like friends had suggested it. And I was like, no. Like, mm-hmm. there's other people that are better, mm-hmm. like more adept at that than me. But I think COVID really kind of laid the groundwork for me to become the version of myself that I am now. And I feel very balanced. So I still provide services and take a select number of clients. Yeah. I've got a physical retail shop. I've got an online retail shop. I've got the podcast, which makes me $0 yet, but it will. Yeah. I think that like the scary thing is like losing like yes. your the roof over your head and mm-hmm. like that security and safety. Mm-hmm. And getting close to that really kind of forced me to reevaluate and kind of renegotiate what I'm doing, where I'm going, what I want, what's important to me.
Yeah.
And so I feel very clear and present on that now.
Yeah, that's great. I have a follow-up question about that. So it's like, yeah. you know, you mentioned balance, and it's just like, how did you know that you were getting closer to being balanced just with everything? Like, what were some indicators for you?
That's a wonderful question. Mm-hmm. I think, so especially as a woman, and at my age, I came up in the kind of toxic girl boss season of things, okay. where you're told what balance is mm-hmm. and not really invited to assess what it means for you. Oh. And what I realized was there's no such thing as actual balance. But for me, it's, hey, I'm going to go hard this week, and then I'm not going to overschedule myself the next week. So if you look at my schedule, it may not look balanced, but for me and my energy levels, it's a net neutral, basically. Mm-hmm. So just really getting clear with myself, and meditation was huge for this too, of just really putting away all the noise and other people's ideas and opinions of what I should be and what I should do, and just being clear with my inner voice and what I need to be happy with myself and content with what I'm creating, and knowing to trust that over anything else. And of course, I love feedback and constructive criticism. That's super important. But yeah, I think I just got really clear. And so it was, you know, I'm going to say no to this thing that I wouldn't have said no to last year, because I know that it's going to put me out of whack for what my goal is. Mm-hmm. So I guess, yeah, did that answer your question?
It does. I think something that resonates a lot is like, you were talking about, 1 week may look different from the next, but yeah. it balances your energy levels.
Yeah.
And I think that resonates a lot, because, like, you know, sometimes we might travel to shoot something or travel for work.
Yeah.
And so then it's important then to have, like, I'm just processing this for myself. It's
for
like,
sure.
So then the next week, you know, maybe don't push it.
That's
you know,
exactly
like,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like, because when you know yourself, you can anticipate what you're going to need. And I was just talking to a friend last night, actually, who travels a ton for work, and he's like having a hard time dating because, you know, he'll have just been out of town for a week and coming home and has no groceries and da da da. And people are like, do you want to get a drink? Like, where do you want to go? What do you want to do? Da da da. And it's like, I don't want to answer these questions. Like, yeah. if you want to get a drink, say, hey, meet me at this place at this time. Mm-hmm. But my bandwidth is like not present right now. Mm-hmm. And, he's like, the priority has to be what pays my bills, like, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And so just knowing, like, don't even try to book a date the night that you just got back in town after a week-long trip, because
right,
you're not
right.
going to be your best self on that date. Mm-hmm. You're going to be tired, and if that person doesn't bring their A game, you're going to be like, what a waste of time.
yeah.
And so I think just figuring out yourself, and a lot of people, you know, social media is so toxic in a lot of ways, of course, but you see these people a day in the life, and it's not a day in their life.
Yeah.
It's content.
Right.
And people are like, oh my God, this is what people are doing. I'm not doing enough. And you compare yourself.
Yeah.
And that is, I stopped doing that. I think that's mm-hmm. like the biggest thing. And I was like, it doesn't matter what she's doing.
Yeah. Oh, you
doesn't
know,
work for me.
That actually brings up another question. Cause you brought something up on a previous episode.
Uh-huh.
You were talking about social media
mm-hmm.
and you were talking about, trying to paraphrase, so I'm starting to miss things.
Yeah, okay.
But you were talking about, like, you know, for your work, like, there's a certain amount of social media that has to happen.
Yeah.
But, like, for you interacting with it in an authentic way,
mm-hmm.
in a way that makes sense, can be challenging. And also, sometimes, like, you don't care about it.
100%.
You know? And, like, I thought that was so interesting. That resonated with me.
Yeah.
Because when we first started putting out videos, like, they were getting views, and so, like, we were putting them on different platforms.
Yeah.
And at the time when we first started doing videos, I was on Facebook and nothing else. So I'd never been on Twitter, never been on Instagram, never been on TikTok. And then I had to join these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so some were pretty cool. I was like, I get it. I get it now with Instagram. But it's like you mentioned comparing earlier.
Yes.
And it's very difficult, you know, not to do that, even if you don't want to be. Absolutely. Because you're just scrolling and you're like, oh, well, they're here, I'm here.
Yes.
And so that in itself is a comparison.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the question is other than like, what works for you?
Well, I guess that depends on how you define what works. I'm still, every day I'm navigating that because mm-hmm. I genuinely don't care. Mm-hmm. So like my Instagram for this podcast, mm-hmm. I think I have like 150 followers. Like, mm-hmm. but the followers I have are engaged. There's some questions and da 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 da. So it's like, of course there's other podcasts that have 25,000 followers and like their videos are on point and they're clearly paying a production company to create all of this. And I find myself like, I'll just set my phone down and I'm like, oh, you're not doing enough. You're not doing enough. And then I remind myself, you're doing the max that you can. I do all of this. I produce mm-hmm. this, I edit this, I publish this, and I enjoy that because again, I'm controlling and it's my creative output. And so at this stage of things, I just have to be comfortable where I'm like, I'm doing as much as I can. And that will evolve as I've watched it evolve in other facets of my career. Mm-hmm. And that will show up online. But at the end of the day, and I was actually having a conversation about this for the Instagram for my retail shop, which is more popular than the podcast. Mm-hmm. But followers don't equal revenue. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of people where you look at their pages and you're like, oh my God, like how do they already have 50,000 followers? Mm-hmm. But you know that person and you're like, oh, they couldn't pay their lease last month. Mm-hmm. So I think that you just have to know that for me and my values, like I'm very, very pleased with the quality of the content that I'm putting out. I'm doing the best job I can while still learning how to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes me sleep well at night, not mm-hmm. having a certain number of followers. Because that's just like the social media people, that's Meta telling mm-hmm. me that like I'm not cool unless I have a lot of followers. And I disagree and I think I'm cool without them. Yeah. So I would of course like to grow it because I want more visibility for this project. Right. But at the end of the day, if it's not going to pay my mortgage, mm-hmm. I don't care.
Right. Yeah, no, that's super helpful. Yeah, and I appreciate you sharing. I like to ask people about it because it's like, you know,
we all deal with it as creatives.
Yeah. Because it's kind of like, it's not as simple being like, oh, I'm going to turn it off. It's like, well, you got to engage with it a little bit.
Correct.
So like, what's working for other people? And like, what can I learn from what other folks are doing?
Yeah, I'm absolutely learning every day because mm-hmm. I don't know what, like, the Magnet Man is actually a great example. I mm-hmm. mean, he started that page 4 mm-hmm. months ago and he's got like 25,000 followers.
Yeah.
And all he's doing is just being so authentically himself. Mm-hmm. And he deserves all of this. I mean, he's mm-hmm. awesome. However, at least as we're recording this, like that page isn't monetized. Mm-hmm. So like he's got great engagement. He's got a lot of followers. Mm-hmm. But again, it doesn't pay his mortgage. Mm-hmm. It's just truly a creative outlet. So it's mm-hmm. like, how do you quantify the value of that number of followers and likes and comments, right?
Right. Yeah.
So, I don't know, man. It's tough. If you're listening, please follow me.
Yeah.
If you don't mind. Totally. And that's another thing too, is like, I'm not good at asking for help. I'm not good at asking for stuff. If I can do it alone, I'm going to do it alone, mm-hmm. which maybe is like a trauma response to things I should talk about in therapy. But I'm not good at being like I kind of am. I want to build it and let it come type of thing. So it's mm-hmm. like, if you feel, and I wonder if this resonates with you, but like, hey, I put it all into the sketch. Like I feel good about this. This is solid. This represents me. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put it out there and just like see what happens and not worry about people's reaction as much.
Mm-hmm. I'm learning to get much better at that, I think.
Yeah.
I've learned to like, I think, cause I think also too, just the way you put comedy out has changed so much now versus like when I started. Mm-hmm. So like, for example, like when I started, if you're like a stand-up comic, you wouldn't put stuff out on the internet because you wouldn't want to burn jokes or like whatever the case may be. And you would wait until it's like, well, wait until you get on TV or something like that. Mm-hmm. But now it's just like, that's flipped. It's just like, you got something good, like put it out there and see what happens, you know? And so I become, I think in a positive way, less concerned, like when I put something out there, like mm-hmm. I'm more like, well, this is interesting to me at this time. I want to put it out. So I'm going to put it out. So, which was not necessarily the case, like when I first started with things. And again, I don't think it was bad then, you know, it was just more so like, I was just like, oh, I want to put out something of this quality. And that's a good mm-hmm. impulse to have. But absolutely. I think also being okay putting something out just to put it out.
Yeah, that's it. And I know, like, there's episodes I've put out where I'm like, was this the best thing I've ever created in my entire life? Like, maybe not. Mm-hmm. But it's, there's still, if somebody has a takeaway and gets a little something from it, then it's worth producing. And not everything we do can be 110% of ourselves at all times. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just an unreasonable or unrealistic mm-hmm. expectation mm-hmm. when you're talking about something creative. It's not math where it's like, this is right or wrong. Yeah, you know, yeah, there's no like binary like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, creative stuff is just tough and subjective. And I think you just have to, if you feel that calling to do something creative, you just mm-hmm. have to do it and put it out there and be like, have integrity behind your work.
Yeah.
And if you feel like it's authentic and a true representation of yourself, then, I mean, I'll sleep sound, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I love that. I had another question for you too. How did you get into comedy originally?
Okay, great question. Mm-hmm. I've always been funny, mm-hmm. and I don't mean that like a braggy way.
No, like, I mean, you're you are a funny person. You are what, yeah, like I know what you mean. You are a funny person.
Yeah, like I just always, I've never have had a hard time making people laugh. And mm-hmm. my dad is hilarious. He's mm-hmm. an asshole, but he is hilarious. And I think I grew up in a household where humor was used to diffuse things and gotcha. To address things. We didn't have a lot of sit down, deep, serious family conversations. Humor was the vehicle for kind of some important content. Back to what you were saying about the you know, civil engagement type of stuff mm-hmm. and kind of putting that under the umbrella of comedy. Mm-hmm. So I think I always grew up being shown there was a value in being funny.
Yeah.
And of course, making people laugh feels good.
Yeah.
And so I never would have thought that I would like be a stand-up or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But I think I had like a business coach. And mm-hmm. I was in my probably mid-20s, late-20s when I started doing improv. And she was mm-hmm. like, this is going to help you with public speaking. Oh. I'm glad you asked me this. I'm like, yeah. I haven't thought about this in a long question. Yeah. I was doing a lot of teaching and educating for my salon work.
Gotcha.
So I'd be going to other cities and other salons. Wow. And, you know, it was getting to the point, I think the biggest group of people I spoke in front of was like maybe 100-ish people. But
that's a lot of people.
And I just got crippling anxiety. Like, right. I didn't like it.
May I ask why? That totally makes sense. I'm not saying like, how's that possible? But
yeah.
when I've seen you speak in class elsewhere, it's just like you could man the room. I'm curious like where that's from, and I also want to learn how you got into comedy. But that was also just interesting too.
I'm curious. That's bravado. That's fake. Mm-hmm. And you know what's funny? Do you remember Ian from Highwire? We had like a post graduation like a feedback sesh, mm-hmm. and I remember sitting down with him. We were at some little like Irish pub, mm-hmm. and he just looked at me and he was like, "Would it kill you to not play an alpha character?" And I was like, Ian, it's never occurred to me to not play an alpha character. Like, I just am, cause it's a control thing though, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, and people always are surprised to hear that about me because I do, when I'm out there, I turn it on and I'm like, everything's fine kind of once I get started.
Sure.
But like that lead up to it, I mean, sweaty palms, heart racing, just, mm-hmm. I mean, uncontrollable anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And it was suggested that I take up improv because it would help me. I mean, I would like rehearse a phone call before I make it type of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And improv, there's no time to be anxious. Like it really helps you to work through that. And I, like the me on the other side of having taken like pretty intensive, I mean, two like pretty intense years of improv education.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. I mean, it's so much better. And I still will get anxious from time to time, but nothing like it was before.
Mm-hmm.
But it was 100% a fake it till you make it mm-hmm. like bravado mm-hmm. thing. Like, yeah.
Yeah. So got into comedy largely just from the public speaking aspect.
Yeah.
But I'm curious, you know, doing it for 2 years, was there something, were there other things too that had you stick with it, I suppose? You know, because in some respects, maybe you could have taken a class, gotten what you needed, and kept going. I'm curious.
I really enjoyed, especially as a woman, mm-hmm. in your late 20s, mid to late 20s, that's when people are starting to get married, starting to have babies, and starting to get boring. And I didn't want to do any of that. And mm-hmm. so I noticed, you know, my social circle kind of fluctuating. And I'm like, you know, I want to do some stuff for me. And I really enjoyed it. I loved the people that I met. I have never dated so much in my life. I was so popular. I'd be like, oh my God. So it was like a really nice little pool to meet people in real life, right?
Yeah.
And I liked the social aspect of it. And I enjoyed knowing like once a week for 2 hours, I'm going to be vulnerable and silly and have fun and just play with other people who maybe I have nothing in common with.
Yeah.
But I loved the like all of the labels that we all have prescribed to ourselves, mm-hmm. I feel like don't necessarily, maybe don't isn't is a stretch, but like, I feel like you leave a lot of that at the door and you can really pretend and play around with being anybody as long as they're not a beta. So really yeah, I just like really enjoyed it. But it's, I guess it's the people that I met along the way and the people that I'm still friends with to this day and really appreciate having experienced knowing in my life.
That's cool. So, and yeah. So you did improv. Did you stand up as well?
I did not do stand up.
Gotcha.
At some point I will. I feel a little bit of a calling to dip my toes into that.
Yeah.
But I haven't yet.
Gotcha, yeah. Lace Larrabee's class is cool. I haven't taken it, but I've seen the students that I see coming out of Lace Larrabee's class are always super hilarious. It seems like a great experience.
We have a previous guest who took classes with Lace Larrabee and suggested them. And so that, it's interesting you're saying that because that seed has been planted. Okay. And I think I would definitely take hers if I were to pursue it.
Yeah, cool.
But I definitely, like, I have a notes app where I'm like, hey, this is a funny thing. And I'll record voice memos of myself, like, telling jokes and stuff like that. Yeah. Sometimes I go back and listen, I'm like, delete. But other times I'm like, there's something here, you know? Like, this could be refined.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I think just humor is so important to me because I do think it's a vehicle for diffusing tension and it allows for conversations around topics that maybe are tough for people. And so, humor is just very, very, very important to me.
Yeah. Cool. That's fun to know.
One
of the things that I enjoy a lot, you know, I mentioned earlier, creating with other folks.
Yeah.
Even if I'm just an audience member, like a spectator.
Right.
Like, I draw a lot of inspiration from that. And I think that something that I'm really thankful for in Atlanta is just like the creative scene. And there's all these really cool pockets of artists making great stuff.
Absolutely.
And so something that is exciting about the show tonight is the people that I'm inviting or people that I feel that way about. Like when I watch them, I'm like, wow, there's something that you do that inspires me in some way. So that's something that I've drawn a lot of inspiration from. Because I think like pre-pandemic, I was so focused on getting on stage as much as I could.
Right.
To get reps and to build those skills. Mm-hmm. And I think in slowing down from the pandemic, something that I think was reminded of how much I enjoy was like, oh, I also like watching this stuff too.
For sure.
You know, and not just comedy, but like going to see a movement piece or going to see a play or going to see a musician or something like that. And so I think something that has recently been exciting for me creatively has been like the role of an audience member and finding inspiration from other folks, just like in different lanes than myself.
So
I really love when those different disciplines come together. So like a variety show style thing, or even you may not even be at a variety show, but like, you know, like when you're at like, I don't know, this is just a random example, like you're at a dance show or something like that, and there's a lot of great dancing going on, you're like, these people are moving, this is fantastic, no one's talking, and then suddenly somewhere someone starts singing lyrics and you're like, what is this? You know, and normally like it wouldn't be that surprising on stage for someone to sing lyrics, but when they haven't been singing the whole time and they start singing, you're like, hey, how about that? And there's certain shows around town where I feel like Wright Club does this really well, where they invite people of different disciplines to come together in one space, and I just really love, you know, that mashup or that desire. You know,
I love that because I do think there's inspiration everywhere in so many unexpected places, and you just have to be open to it. And seeing people interpret things differently and perform them is just so cool. And Atlanta's the best. I mean, there are issues with Atlanta, of course, but it's creatively, it's such a wonderful city to be in. And we're surrounded by so many people who just like are passionate and just are trying to put out really cool stuff. And I think it just invites all of us to level up and just, you know, produce at our best level as we can.
And I think like from watching those artists that I, you know, really enjoy a lot, it's informed a lot of my work in the sense of like how I collaborate with folks, you know, because like a lot of what we do with cool productions is like, you know, we'll collaborate with an organization or a company or whoever. And it's like, and it's not always just comedy, but it's like, how can we create some sort of content with you to help you, you know, tell your own story the way you want to see it told, you know? And so it's learning how to work with people that may not necessarily be comedians or may not necessarily, you know, consider do storytelling all day, every day,
right,
you know, but they have stories and they have a point of view in learning, like, how can we kind of bring this together? Mm-hmm. I think that's why I'm attracted to the variety show format, because it sort of then shows up in the work, you know, yeah. like, and that's something that's really cool. Like, so for example, Bill and I are working with some folks in the public health space. I don't know anything about public health. I'm learning a little bit about it, but it's like, it's definitely like a new space, and learning how we each see things differently, but like seeing where we meet mm-hmm. is something that's been really great. So like different forms of collaboration where you're kind of like trying to blend things, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's been something that I've really, I think, appreciated most about, you know, getting to do this production company stuff.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Well, Mark, I'm excited to see you in just a couple hours
for
this variety show.
Yeah, yeah.
This episode will air after that, but I will link all of your information and stuff like that.
You.
And then I'll share it on our, you know, page today. So hopefully, is it sold out?
It's sold out, but just like, you know, come by and try and get
okay.
a seat. Yeah, yeah,
okay,
yeah,
okay.
yeah, yeah.
It's loosely sold out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Well, Mark, will you let people know where they can find you?
Yeah. So, my name is Mark Kendall. So on like Instagram, if you want to see my comedy videos and stuff, look at Mark Kendall Comedy. But for cool production stuff, you can go to coolcoolcoolpro.com. You can also look me up on LinkedIn there, you know, if you want to look at that more corporate side or whatever. Also, I'm just around Atlanta, too. So I'll post about shows that I'm doing or where I'm performing. So come say hello.
Yeah, perfect. And I'll link all of that in the show notes, of course, also. Mark, thank you so much again for your time. This has been so enjoyable and such a treat to get to spend so much one-on-one time with you.
Yeah.
You can find Clover Club on Instagram at Clover Club Pod. And friendly reminder, listeners get 15% off at HawkinsandClover.com with promo code Clover Club, all caps. And Mark, I'll see you tonight.
Yeah.
Listeners, I'll hear you next week. And yes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye. Yay!
This table is awesome.